Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Up next on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, we'll play for you a special rebroadcast of Civic Cypher, originally aired on February 2022, where Ramses Ja and Q Ward discussed their understanding of the Black experience, based on media influencer and businessman Dan Price and on his reach and involvement in social media. They also discussed critical race theory and the life of the late Black actor pioneer Sidney Poitier. Civic Cypher with Ramses Ja and Q Ward is aired every Friday at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to another episode of Civic Cypher. I am your host, Ramses Ja.
And I go by the name Q Ward most of the time.
Yes, indeed. Back up in you one more again. Feeling real good this week. Black History Month. A lot of good things going on in the world of Civic Cypher and Q Ward and Ramses Ja. And it's all because of you, our listeners, supporting us. If you don't know what I'm talking about, we don't need to brag about it on air. Check the social media, but suffice it to say, the show is growing and we are reaching more people, and it's because of your support. So thank you.
It's because of y'all.
It's because of y'all.
Because of y'all.
Bling, bling. That's all I got to say. You know, Q and I, we have a lot of inside jokes, but that's because we spend so much time together. But the source that we pull from more often than not is a stand-up special by Jamie Foxx called I Might Need Security. If you listen to the show every week, please watch Jamie Foxx I Might Need Security, because then you'll get a lot of these inside jokes. But we don't dwell on them because we have a lot of stuff to get to.
He did not pay us for that endorsement, but it's hilarious.
Yeah, it's good for your spirit. Anyway, be sure to stick around because we do have a lot to cover today. We're going to do something we don't really do very often, and that's really plug in to one person, one stream of consciousness, one school of thought that we really feel is timely and pertinent and necessary and enlightening, at least for me. I'm sure that Q would agree that there's some things that even Q learns. And he goes by the name of Dan Price. He's not even from our world. He's from the business world. But we're gonna discuss a lot of interesting points that he makes. And we're also going to focus for our Way Black History Fact on Sidney Poitier. We didn't get a chance to discuss him until today. So we're going to definitely do that deep dive. The late great, yes, indeed. But first, like we always do at this time, it's time for some Ebony Excellence. How does that sound, Q?
Sounds fantastic. I love that we start the show with Ebony Excellence, because a lot of times our topics are weighty. They take a lot from us, sometimes emotionally. And to kind of start, and we kind of start and end on a high note. The Way Black sometimes has some weight as well.
Yeah.
But it's historic precedence and importance. I think, you know, gives it a little bit of lift as well.
Yeah, it just shows kind of where we've come from. But I digress. So today we're talking about a young man named Archie Green, who is the founder of Peel Dim Layers Back, PDLB. That is a Cleveland, Ohio nonprofit designed to help Black male youth with their mental health. He was diagnosed with depression, and he uses his platform as a hip hop artist to share stories about trauma, depression, anxiety, relationships, and fatherhood through music. He launched his nonprofit in 2016 and a program called Cope Dealers Initiative, where high school counselors and teachers identify juniors and seniors who have had behavior and anxiety challenges and could benefit from a program focused on their mental health. And his position is that African Americans often face barriers when accessing quality mental health treatment because of racism and limited access to culturally competent mental health professionals. And that is according to Mental Health America. You can find out more about him at pdlb.org. Once again, his name is Archie Green, and the company is called Peel Dim Layers Back. And the reason I wanted to hit on this briefly is because, and we'll talk about this, we have seen recently a lot of Black men and women end their lives prematurely and deliberately. And historically, that's not been a thing that we've had to, as a community, we've really had to deal with. And more as time progresses, we're seeing it happen more often. And so eventually we'll have the time to talk about it. But for now, if you want to, you know, support or even know a little bit more about this initiative, again, it's pdlb.org. So big shout out to Archie Green. That is some ebony excellence for you. Now,
time for Cleveland, Ohio as well.
Yes, one time if you don't mind. Okay, so Dan Price, I'll be honest. Dan Price he's a new person in my world. He's very active on Twitter. He's just and he's a businessman. But I'll try to paint a profile for you. Now, this isn't about him per se, but some of the points that he makes, because this stream of consciousness is, when I came across it, I shared it with Q. You remember when I sent it to our group chat? And there was so much content there that we early on made it a point to block out a show to really talk about some of these things, just to discuss them, to share them. And, you know, maybe you're on Twitter and you've seen this, maybe not, but we're going to try to make it breathe a little bit more. So a little bit about this person and who he is and how he came to be. So he started a company called Gravity Payments about 6 years ago, and he made news. I remember hearing about this, but he made the news for raising his company's minimum wage to $70,000 a year. Fox News called him a socialist whose employees would be on breadlines. And since then, his revenue has tripled. The business is a Harvard Business School case study, and the employers had a 10 times boom in homes bought. On his Twitter profile, he says that he's a CEO just trying to stand up for the underdog. Again, his handle is at Dan Price Seattle. I implore you to follow him and plug in, because there's a lot of stuff, not just the stuff we're talking about today. And he just seems like a good human being who money and success has not corrupted. And it's amazing to see, because so often we see folks, the more money they get, the more conservative, at least fiscally, you know, they become. And this guy seems to be a kind-hearted person who really does share and really does try to build people who have a tougher go at things in this country. Real quick before we go on, earlier for our Ebony Excellence segment, I pulled that content from the Atlanta Black Star if you wanted to check out more on that. Again, this current segment where we're talking about Dan Price, I just pulled it from his Twitter, so we're going to talk about it. So the first thing that he shared, the first slide in this stream of consciousness, I shouldn't even call it that, but we're here now, so we're going to roll with it. The first slide that came across my way that Q and I discussed was him writing as follows. And he's white, by the way. All right. He says, compared to white people, black owned homes are devalued by 23%. Black owned homes property taxes are 13% higher. Bank fees are 2 times higher for black people. Black people with no criminal record earn $10,000 less than white people with a criminal record. That's just the beginning, dot, dot, dot. So we're going to go through each one of these slides one by one. But that first one is crazy, right? But the craziest part about it is we've talked about these, some at length, but all of these things that we've talked about on the show before. And one recent one that comes to mind is the couple, I believe they were in Northern California, who got an appraisal on their house. And then they went through and they had like some friends stand, if I remember correctly, effectually, this is what they did. They got some friends to stand in while the appraiser came, a new appraiser came. They changed all the pictures in their house. So they took all their family pictures down and they put like white pictures on the wall. And then the new appraiser gave them an extra $500,000 in equity on the property, right? So what Dan Price says here, like right out the gates, compared to white people, black-owned homes are devalued by 23%, which jives with a story, a case study that we made on the show. Go ahead.
And when it comes to housing prices, 23% is a massive amount. Like the number 23% when you're comparing it to 100 doesn't sound like a lot. But if you have a $500,000 home, you're talking about a $100,000 difference in price. That's massive.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we talk about wealth because in fact, the majority of instances, there is a direct correlation between the amount of wealth might throw folks off. So how about we say income or money, you know, the amount of money and opportunities, pitfalls, you know, there's a correlation there. And oftentimes in this country, money follows the color line. And so, you know, we make a point on this show to really discuss how we treat each other. Certainly how black folks are treated by white folks. But, you know, we're all here together. You know, we do have to make points sometimes when black people are wrong and saying racist things. We have to stand up against that the same as we would against anyone. But for the most part, you know, there's systemic institutions in place and they are relics of white supremacy, not even really relics because there are still active contributors to these systems. And not all of them come from the Republican Party, if I'm honest. But, you know, the point is that we have to have these conversations about how we treat each other. But there is also something to say about capitalism. We have this conversation all the time. And now, whether or not you are a fan of capitalism or, you know, whatever is beside the point. Certain things are just a natural byproduct of capitalism. There are byproducts of socialism. There's byproducts of communism, right? We just talk about those. And to be fair, we do beat up on capitalism quite a bit. I don't think either of us are huge fans of it, but in the same way, we're not huge fans of a lot of things. It's just kind of what we were born into. Go ahead.
I think a reason that we have such tilted views, and the audience can't see me tilting my hand downward, such tilted views with regard to capitalism is that some of the byproducts are actually requirements.
Yeah.
Like there's some byproducts of socialism that requires for everyone to kind of lift everyone else, which is not that awful a byproduct when you say it out loud the way I just said it. There's a way you can frame that different and make it seem like, you know what I mean? There are people intentionally doing nothing to weigh us all down kind of thing. But there's some requirements of capitalism that are, it's more required than a byproduct. Capitalism can't exist unless part of the population has nothing. That's a requirement, not a byproduct.
I'll make a point for you. One of the things that blew my mind is that in order for capitalism to function optimally, there has to be some unemployment to keep wages low. That means that everyone doesn't get a job. Some people need to be unemployed so that wages will stay low. And if the system is framed around that concept, let's keep wages low, and some people will have to go without a job. If you have an economic system framed around that, I believe that morally we've started on the wrong foot. With that said, I'm not saying I'm a bigger fan of anything else. I just, you know, we have to work with the system that we're given, and so we will. All right, I'll move on. The next slide. This again, Dan Price Seattle. At Dan Price Seattle, if you want to check this out for yourself on his Twitter feed. Black college grads have 50% less wealth than white high school dropouts.
Say that again, please.
Black college grads have 50% less wealth than white high school dropouts. Now, this is an average. You know, this is, you know, I'm a college grad and I know a lot of white dropouts.
Don't apologize, sir. Read those.
A spoonful of sugar,
a little bit of honey. Read those statistics as they are written. Do not apologize. Okay. And do not try to frame it and give it some type of lighter moral compass.
Okay.
Read that as it's written because it's staggering.
Listen. It's your show, Q. Yes, sir. Black college grads have 50% less wealth than white high school dropouts. And then I'll just leave that there. This, again, from a white man who is successful with a successful business and obviously a huge Twitter following and online presence. The next point in this slide, the 10 counties most audited by the IRS are 79% people of color. The black-white homeowner gap is bigger now than it was in the year 1900. And finally, for this slide, in the pandemic, black-owned businesses closed at twice the rate. So further illuminating that, you know, there are really two different Americas. I think that, you know, there's a reason why you had such a reaction to the black college grads having 50% less wealth than white high school dropouts, not just because, again, the point makes itself that opportunities follow the money, right? And what we're seeing is a cycle. We can go to the government and appeal to the government and say, hey, we want to drink out of the same water fountain. And hey, we'd like to use the same bathroom. We'd like a little bit of dignity. We'd like to be able to go to the same schools. We'd like access, you know, in that way. But not enough can be said about money. Not just money to pay for opportunities, but money to live healthy, productive lives. Money to have the mental freedom and fortitude to take advantage, to even conceive in the first place of opportunities. For those of you listening to our voices tonight or today, whenever you're listening, it might be easy to imagine, might not be, but we will be the ones to tell you. Q is from Detroit, not the good side of town. Let them know where you're from, Q.
I'm from a small town in Michigan. It goes by the name of Detroit. Some people even call it Motown or the Motor City.
Tell them about that street. What's that number?
And I grew up on a very, very prominent road, affectionately known as 7 Mile.
Okay. So if you don't know about 7 Mile, do a little bit of homework. You'll find out. And then I will add to that I was born in a place called Compton, California. A place that in most instances needs no introduction. And what I want to suggest by saying this is that there's a great deal of hopelessness in those communities. And there is a sense of this is the whole world, or otherwise, this is the world that I'm allowed to experience. To think of something that exists on TV in your own life is, it may as well be thinking of like the same way you would think of a cartoon. You know, cartoon characters run faster, jump higher. They, you know, they have the same hair every day, whatever it is you think, you know, it's just, it's cool to see it. You're aware that it is something that you could imagine, but it's not real. So these numbers, these sobering numbers, they're not necessarily sobering for people that live this life, but you know, if you're listening to our voices and, you know, maybe you didn't know these things, this is the reality of the situation. It certainly jives with everything that we know to be true. All right, so I'll move on to the next slide here. All Black Americans combined have half of the wealth of the nation's richest 400 people. I'll say it one more time. All Black Americans combined. That's Jay-Z, Beyonce, that's everybody that you ever met in school, their parents, their grandparents. Oprah. One more time, Q.
Oprah,
yeah, all of them. Jordan.
Very, very Black people you can think of, them too.
But not just them. You know, the people you've never met, people that you see at the bus stop, people you see at the grocery store, people you see at Walmart, people might be driving in traffic next to you if you're driving while you're listening to us. If you see a Black person, add their wealth in as well. Every single Black person in this country combined, they have half the wealth of the nation's richest 400 people. Half the wealth.
Just to give you guys some further context, there are about 42 million Black people in America. All of them put together, including the richest Black people that you've ever heard of, make up half the wealth of the nation's richest 400.
Now, you said 42 million Black people?
Million.
And then there was half the wealth of 400?
Of 400.
So, let me add something right here. I know, this is not me trying to sugarcoat anything. I know that you could make a lot of, draw a lot of conclusions based on how rich the rich are and how regular the rest of us are. But when you're talking about this many people in these type of circumstances, it certainly does help frame the importance of wealth and how it is unevenly distributed, so much so that a lot of the issues, at least a lot of the issues that have kind of run rampant, you can see like, well, the resources aren't available to fix them because the resources are with these handful of people over there, right? I think that might be another strike against capitalism, but I'll move on. The rest of this third slide here says the average inheritance for white families is three times that of Black families. And then the last point of this slide says, relatedly, Black families have $166,000 less wealth than white families, a bigger gap than before civil rights. So since the civil rights movement, the gap has widened between white families and Black families in terms of wealth. All right, I'll move on. Let's talk about school. College is not an equalizer. I think we established that in the second slide. College is not an equalizer. Black college grads have $25,000 more student debt than white grads. I don't even know how that's possible. Actually, you know what? I still own student loans, so let me, I guess I can see how it's possible. But, you know, Black college grads have $25,000 more student debt than white grads. White millennials with a degree have 10 times higher net worth than Black grads. And 20 years after graduating, the median white grad owes 5% of their student loan balance, and Black grads owe 95%. That's after 20 years. So that means that white graduates are paying down, dare I say, able to pay down their student loans to 5% after 20 years. And Black folks are still wrestling with basically the entirety of it, 95% after graduating, 20 years after graduating. And I don't know if this person, Dan Price, the CEO of the company, the person who like listed these, which by the way, all of his sources are there as well. I don't know if he's a college grad or not, but he seems very passionate about this, and he seems unafraid to share these statistics. And I think that we need more of that. You know, there's nothing to be afraid of here. If we identify the problem, we can work on it. We're all in this together. That's my take at least. All right, I'll move on. The Electoral College's lopsidedness gives the median Black voter 16% less power than the typical white voter. Now, I remember seeing something like this on Netflix. They did a special on the election. This was sometime last year, when maybe October-ish or whatever. It's still there. I don't remember the name of it. But they talked about the vote, the weight of a vote of a white conservative vote, male vote in Wisconsin compared to like a Black vote in Los Angeles. And that white vote in terms of the actual impact is so much more significant. And it's just because of the Electoral College. So it's effectively is telling us that it punishes Black folks. It disenfranchises, you know, black and brown people and other marginalized people and favors, you know, white men in terms of the outcomes. Black workers get unemployment benefits at half the rate of white workers. And since the Civil War / slavery ended, Black families went from having 0.5% of all wealth to 1.5%. So that is some gain. But remember, they went from that was after slavery ended. So we've gained 1 point since the Civil War when effectively Black folks had nothing. So we still have nothing. We have, relatively speaking, still nothing. We make up a huge amount of the population. And then I'll make this last point. Black people are 4 times more likely than white people to be arrested for marijuana. And Black sons of families in the richest 1% are arrested at the same rate as white sons of families in the poorest third. And finally, Black students are 2.5 times more likely than white students to be arrested at school. And unfortunately, we have to move on.
And now, Proper propaganda.
Watch it. Pull my mic back. You like that? Journalist with journalist too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders.
If you're just tuning in to Civic Cypher, I am your host, Ramses Jah.
I go by the name of Q Ward.
Yes, indeed. And if you're just tuning in, be sure to stick around because we're examining some interesting points made by a social media influencer. We call him. His name is Dan Priciano. He had a stream of consciousness not too long ago and put some hard-hitting facts up, and we're reviewing them now. But let's, before we get back into that, discuss how to become a better ally. So we're talking about this gentleman, Dan Price, at Dan Price Seattle on Twitter. And for today's Baba, become a better ally, I would like for you to follow him, subscribe to his feed. Even if you don't want to follow him, review it. You'll see that these sources are well documented. You'll be able to, you know, it's just one of those rabbit holes that you might want to plug into. If you want to become a better ally, if you want to become a better brother or sister to, you know, people who don't look like you, this is the way to do it. But he's not the only one. There's another person I'm a big fan of. His name is Brian Stevenson, and he is the person behind the movie Just Mercy, starring Jamie Foxx and Michael B. Jordan. But I've known Brian Stevenson for a very, very long time. I got put onto him in like 2012 or something because of a TED Talk. I love this guy. And you can follow him at EJI_ORG, EJI standing for Equal Justice Initiative, which is his initiative. If, you know, inmate rights and you know, the criminal justice system is more your thing. You know, Dan Price, of course, is more about economics and business and that sort of stuff. But Brian Stevenson, EJI.org, be sure to check him out if, you know, the criminal justice system is something you need to learn about. A group I follow on Facebook that I really wish more people knew about is called Audit the Audit. And what they do is they monitor police interactions, and they'll take the video and they'll have a lawyer or some educated person examine what's happening during the interactions. And it's just a great way to get educated so that we know what's happening, and we can, I think that's the best way to support the police, is by knowing what it is they should be doing. And I will leave you with a name, JaneElliott.com, even if you don't really plug in, she's someone that you need to know about. And that is how you can become a better ally. Now, back to Dan Price. I feel like I want to get some thoughts from you, Q, before we jump back in. How are you feeling so far?
I just want people to kind of process all this data and this information with this lens. These are not random statistical anomalies. It'd be impossible for these statistics to be slighted this heavy in disfavor of Black people. It'd be impossible for that to be random. So view all of this information through that lens. This is systemic. This is intentional. This is not just by happenstance. Like, man, all of those statistics really just randomly worked out that way for those people? No, they absolutely did not. This system was very intentionally put into place to have these outcomes. And when you're hearing all of this information through that lens, it hits you a little bit different.
I want to read
or
something.
At least it should.
I want to read something that I came across. I might share this on our social media page eventually, which, by the way, follow us at Civic Cipher, CIVICCIPHER, on all social media. To your point, Q, and this is about critical race theory. Normally I don't do this sort of thing, but just, I think it helps illustrate your point. A person asked, I get that the GOP does not want CRT, critical race theory, to be taught in schools, but can you tell me what CRT really is? And the answer is, my pleasure. Critical race theory was developed by a largely African-American group of law professors starting in the 1970s when they noticed that the elimination of racist laws didn't actually do much to make the justice system less racist. The theory part is that systems and institutions set up prior to the elimination of racist laws still maintain those racist origins and are why the legal system still has racist outcomes, such as the fact that Black people are less likely to have charges dropped before trial than white people. It's something you might study in a postgraduate law program, assuming you're working with one of the dozen or so professors that are actually working in that area. As such, you won't study it in law school, university, and especially not in high school or elementary school. It would be like trying to teach topography in math class. You need a lot more math than you'll ever be able to learn in high school to even begin to try to understand it. Now, what people try to say is critical race theory, like teaching about racism in America, is actually what is known as American history. Children in elementary school and high school aren't being taught that now because people who actually did those bad things are often still alive and don't want people to know what bad things they did. One of the problems is that slavery is taught as the history of Black people and not the history of white people. So I think it was important to read that because, again, it illustrates that there are systems that are set up where even if you change the laws, the system, the mechanism creates these outcomes. And it's reinforced subtly in the minds of some people, but also in the framework of society, like subtle conditioning and then more formal institutions elsewhere. You know, we talk about them all the time. you know, and I don't, I'm learning to not bully the police, because I don't believe that two wrongs make a right. And I do recognize the human beings in the uniforms, but I will forever remain critical of the institution as long as that institution ends lives needlessly. Pretty much as long as you're carrying guns, because that feels a little like, all right, Lou, just in case I need to end a life today. Go ahead, Q, jump in.
That's a very interesting way to put that. Just in case I, you know, might need to kill someone today, let's make sure we got the tools that we need.
Yeah, why not get a bulletproof vest? If you need to protect yourself, that's protection. A gun is to kill someone. I don't know, man. Or put in the trunk.
I wanted to point out the use, or almost the manipulation of people's very vague understanding of critical race theory. A certain sector of our population has gone to dog whistling in a way that they know a lot of people don't know what that means, right? They've made it scary, attached it to everything having anything to do with segments of American history like slavery, and scared people into thinking our kids shouldn't learn about this, even though, as you just pointed out, they're not one and the same. You guys don't want us to teach our kids American history is what it is. But if you said that out loud, people would think you were ridiculous. So you have to brand it as critical race theory, knowing that hundreds of millions of people have no idea what that means. Make it a scary term, just like socialism, because a lot of people don't know what that means either. But if I can make it scary and give it a somewhat permanent negative connotation, I can dog whistle at large groups of people using these scary terms and get the outcomes that I want. So it's interesting to hear you read that definition, because I'm sure there are people listening to this show that heard that definition for the first time today, but have heard critical race theory said 100 times before.
Yeah, and they didn't know what it was. Yeah. Well, to their credit, the right, the conservative wing of this country, is excellent when it comes to marketing. Especially marketing fear. I've never, like, wow. I went to school for marketing. I have a degree hanging on my wall. So I can see it. And it is not got milk. It is not, you know, have it your way. It is not that. It is different. It is like they get in the head of these people and freak them out. They have a lot of people thinking that we are the enemy. It's the wildest thing. Yo, the only thing that we ask for is equality and never revenge. Never in any circle have I ever heard that we need to get revenge. No, we need to get equality. We need to get equity. We need to get a fair shot. We need to, you know, we need what this country has promised to its citizens.
Most people would view as minimums.
Yeah,
minimum. It's the most that we ask for, the absolutely. Minimum.
Absolutely, absolutely. So let's get back into Dan Price. That detour was necessary. I'm glad we took that one, but let's get back here. So there's some more slides. Before we get into this, there are some people, Black people, who make a point of identifying quote unquote white saviors. What this term means is a person that comes in and says, oh, poor Black people, I'm white, so I'm going to save them. As opposed to, hey, look, this doesn't look right. I respect Black people and brown people. They're thinkers. They're not just rappers and singers and, you know, all that, dancers. They're thinkers, you know, they're leaders, they're politicians, they're everything that anyone else is. So we will figure out what it is that they need for their communities by asking them and then empower them to take such action, right? So not I'm going to step in and get all the shine and the glory, but I'm going to empower them. So this is the difference between what would be known as a white savior and a good person.
An ally.
An ally, there you go, an ally. And before anybody comes at me, telling me, why did you do a whole show on this white savior? I don't think that this guy is. At no point did I, in my research for today's show, did I see him insert himself into some circumstances where a Black person's voice would have carried further, or a Black person's actions would have meant more, or anything like that. He is a businessman who is speaking to corporate interests and economics in a space where most of the people that are observing what he's doing and finding out what works look like him. I call that an ally. And if you have a problem with that, then you can come see me. But I implore you, be careful with that one. I don't, and that's, oh man, I wish that everybody just kind of knew that we're all trying to get there together. We don't need to tear each other down. If we get it wrong, you know, not just us, anyone, if you get it wrong, talk to us. I gotta tear it down. Anyway, I'll get back to it. So his next slide, he says, let me give you a little bit more history. So his slides are a little bit about, not just about race. This stream of consciousness has a lot to do with race, but he's also talking about, you know, teachers and education, healthcare, you know, workers' rights, you know, quality of life, of course, economics, you know, business, all that sort of stuff, and standing up for the underdog, like he says. So recently put up a post that said, 18 years ago today, I started my company, Gravity Payments. I was 19 years old and just trying to survive. We now have over 200 employees, over $50 million a year in revenue, pay everyone a living wage. Again, $70,000 minimum wage at his company. And have never had one layoff. He says, my secret, great employees, CEOs don't matter, workers do. I think that that better identifies who he is as a person. And this thing we're talking about today is one facet of that. He hasn't built his whole identity around, you know, anything like rescuing Black folks. And even that, I take issue with it, because if someone did, if that was their life's mission, I don't think that's the worst thing in the world. I do get that some people take issue, and I guess I can understand why, but I don't have a problem with that. Go ahead.
And I mean, that's similar to the conversation that you and I had before, because to outsiders, people's intentions matter, right? But sometimes outcomes should outweigh intentions. Even if a person's entire mission was to say, hey, look at me, I'm awesome, look at all these Black people I helped. If we're looking at all the Black people they helped, then I don't care that it's clout chasing. I don't care that their reason for it was to ultimately big themselves up if the outcomes are still righteous.
Thank you.
We had that issue, just to give you guys full transparency. When we started the Change Society and hashtag Lunchback, more specifically, one of our flagship programs, it's a social media program. Hence the name, hashtag Lunchbag. And we got a lot of pushback from people saying, hey, get the cameras out of those people's faces. You know,
we were feeding homeless people with this program.
Stop saying, hey, look at me, I'm so great because I'm doing this thing, and just do it. And it's like, sure, the five of us could just do it. But by sharing it on social media, millions of people all over the world got involved. 70, 80 cities at a time, all at once, feeding millions of people because of social media. So of course, some people came out because it was a good look on their Instagram to be seen doing something good for people. But the outcomes were still righteous. Those people still got food and meals that they wouldn't have gotten. And we're talking millions of people.
Absolutely.
So I'll take it.
I'm with you there, but you know, we obviously this show, we created this show to be a Black show for non-Black people, you know, to create better allies, to empower folks, the people that were out on the streets that wanted to know where to go, what to do in 2020. Where do I go? How do I support? What do I put on my sign? What does this mean? What does that mean? What is it that you want? How can I help? You know, there was nothing talking to those people. No show like this in this space, in the radio space, on these stations that was doing that. And so we created this. But again, the conclusion, the outcomes is more important than anything. And so people come at us you know, because, you know, Black people listen to the show as well. And some folks take issue, and that's okay because we don't know everything. But as long as the tone is good and positive, then we'll all get there. I mean, it's a very difficult job to do, but I love you all. Doesn't matter who you are, what color you're from, or what color, where you're from, or anything like that. My job is to love you, and I'm doing my best for you. All right, let's get back to these slides. All right, I'm going to burn through a few of these. First, Black-owned businesses get 3% of all business loans. Black people own 1% of all stocks. Black people own 4% of legal cannabis businesses. Under 1% of Fortune 500 CEOs are Black women. Scooter startup Bird, you know those little scooters in every city? Scooter startup Bird got more funding than all Black women upstarts combined in 2020. In 1950, Black men made 51 cents for every $1 white men made. Now, 51 cents. So that means it has not changed. Americans think Black people have 90% of the wealth while white people do. Oh, sorry. Americans think Black people have 90% of the wealth white people do. So Americans think Black people have 90% of the wealth of white folks. It's actually 10%. Black homeowners are still 5 times more likely to be in old redlined areas 50 years after redlining was outlawed. That is why you need critical race theory. That. Do you see the legal implications of a system that was outlawed, and what are the long-term implications of it? How do systems continually affect, you know, these communities after the laws have been passed and changed and so forth? That is where critical race theory comes into play. No one in elementary school is going to learn about this. And if they did, they wouldn't look at themselves like, oh my gosh, I'm a bad person. Oh, woe is me. You know, at least that's my take on it. All right, I'll move on. Black Americans are 3 times more likely than white people to be killed by the police.
That's 300% more likely, by the way. Because 3 times makes it sound small. That's 300% more likely.
I like the way you said it better. In 8 cities, the rate of police killing Black men is higher than the general U.S. murder rate. Facial recognition is 100 times more likely to misidentify Black faces than white ones. This all came out on the same, all these slides came out on the same day. So you can imagine the impact that it had on me and Q. All right, I'll continue. Distributions from corporate stock buybacks and dividends in the last 15 years benefited white people 72 times more than Black people. Black-owned small businesses were 3 times less likely than white-owned businesses to get a PPP bailout. Minimum wage workers are twice as likely to be Black than white. Whew. All right. 37% of Black families have $0 in net worth. I'll say that one more time. 37% of Black families have no net worth. That is $0. And that's twice the rate of white families. Under the post-World War II GI Bill, 0.1% of homes went to Black military vets. 0.1. Not 1%, and 99% went to everyone else. 0.1 went to Black military vets.
0.9% went to everybody else.
Thank you. Yeah.
99.9.
There it is. Black voters are 74% more likely than white voters to wait at least 30 minutes at the polls. Oh, I bet they love that on the right. All right. Median net worth white families with kids, $68,838.
Read that again.
The median net worth of white families with kids is $63,838. The median net worth of Black families with kids is $808. So the numbers, 63,838 versus 808. So it's over 63,000 more dollars And it's not even that the amount is important. It's just it's nothing.
So grossly disproportionate.
Yeah, that's crazy. And we talked, I think it was last week, we talked about how having money in the house affects the brain development for babies. If a mother who's just given birth, a postpartum, I think that's what it's called, or freshly birthed, you know, seed in the house, man, their brain develops better when there's fiscal resources. This is like a scientific thing. We talked about it on a previous show. Feel free to hit the website, civicsoccer.com, and download it. And then our last slide here. From 1930 to 1960, 1% of all mortgages were issued to Black people. Today, home lenders are 80% more likely to reject a Black person's application than a white person with the same finances. And finally, Black millennials' net worth is 52% lower than their parents at this same age. Once again, you know what? Before we go, about 30 seconds, Q, any final thoughts?
These numbers are staggering. And just to echo my point from before, it's a statistical impossibility for all of these truths to be random. It's absolutely intentional, absolutely systemic, and absolutely on purpose. And that's the part that makes it so disgusting.
Yeah. Well, again, I implore you to check out on Twitter at Dan Price Seattle. All the sources for all of his statistics are there, so you can examine them. I looked at the sources too, because I don't want to take some nonsense and put it on the radio, because then y'all be coming after me, and I don't need that problem. So check them out for yourself. It is very insightful. And I think you'll become a more empathetic human being after seeing that, and maybe it'll inspire some creativity along the way. Now, the way Black History Facts. Sidney Poitier, he died earlier this year at age 94. And I will be reading a bit from CNN.com in their article that they wrote after he passed. Poitier overcame an impoverished background in the Bahamas and softened his thick island accent to rise to the top of his profession at a time when prominent roles for Black actors were rare. He won the Oscar for 1963's Lilies of the Field, in which he played an itinerant laborer who helps a group of white nuns build the chapel. Many of his best-known films explored racial tensions as Americans were grappling with social changes wrought by the civil rights movement. In 1967 alone, he appeared as a Philadelphia detective fighting bigotry in small-town Mississippi in the Heat of the Night, and a doctor who wins over his white fiancé's skeptical parents in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. That's the one I know him for. Poitier's movies struggled for distribution in the South, if that makes sense, and his choice of roles was limited to what white-run studios would produce. Racial taboos, for example, precluded him from most romantic parts, but his dignified roles helped audiences in the 50s and 60s envision Black people not just as servants, but as doctors, teachers, and detectives. We got a good one for today. At the same time as the lone Black leading man in 1960s Hollywood, he came under tremendous scrutiny. He was too often hailed as a noble symbol of his race and endured criticism from some Black people who said he had betrayed them by taking sanitized roles and pandering to whites. It's hard to please everyone, but I do understand, you know, Black folks, you know, people that have been hurt, my people, have been hurt so much that to be critical of everything, it makes sense. So I just bark. I'm not mad. If you guys want to be critical of me, that's okay. It's been an enormous responsibility, Poitier told Oprah Winfrey in 2000, and I accepted it, and I lived in a way that showed how I respected that responsibility. I had to. In order for others to come behind me, there were certain things I had to do. As a young actor, he overcame enormous challenges. The youngest of seven children, Sidney Poitier was born several months premature in Miami on February 20th, 1927. So tiny, he could fit in his father's hand. His parents were tomato farmers who often traveled to and from Florida and the Bahamas. He was not expected to live. His mother consulted a palm reader who assuaged her fears. The lady took her hand and started speaking to my mother. "Don't worry about your son. He will survive," Poitier told CBS News in 2013. And these were her words. She said, "He will walk with kings." When he was 15, Poitier's parents sent him from the Bahamas to live with an older brother in Miami, where they figured they would have better opportunities. Poitier didn't like Miami, and soon he headed up north to New York, where he tried his hand at acting. It did not go well at first. With limited schooling, he had trouble reading a script. But he got a job as a dishwasher in a restaurant, where a fortuitous encounter changed his life. An elderly waiter took an interest in the teen and spent nights after work reading the newspaper with him to improve his comprehension, grammar, and punctuation. "That man, every night, the place closed, everyone's gone, and he sat there with me week after week after week," Poitier told CBS News. "And he told me about punctuation. He told me where what dots were and what dots mean between these two words and all that stuff." Soon after, Poitier landed work with the American Negro Theater, where he took acting lessons, softened his Bahamian accent, and landed a stage role as an understudy to Harry Belafonte. This led to roles on Broadway and eventually caught the attention of Hollywood. Poitier's first movie was 1950's No Way Out, a noir film in which he played a young doctor who must treat a racist patient. That led to increasingly prominent roles as a revered in the apartheid drama Cry, the Beloved Country, a troubled student in Blackboard Jungle, and an escaped prisoner in The Defiant Ones, in which he and Tony Curtis were shackled together and forced to get along to survive. With that 1958 film, Poitier became the first Black man to be nominated for an Oscar. But for a dark-skinned actor in the 1950s, finding complex roles was difficult. Quote, "Blacks were so new in Hollywood, there was almost no frame of reference for us except as stereotypical one-dimensional carriers," Poitier told Winfrey. "I had in mind what was expected of me, not just what other Blacks expected, but what my mother and father expected and what I expected of myself." Early on, Poitier made a conscious decision to reject roles that weren't consistent with his values or that reflected badly upon his race. He told Winfrey that as a struggling young actor, he turned down a role that paid $750 a week because he didn't like the character, a janitor who didn't respond after thugs killed his daughter and threw her body on his lawn. Quote, "I could not imagine playing that part. So I said to myself, that's not the kind of work I want," end quote. "That's not the kind of work I want," and told my agent that I couldn't play the role, end quote. Poitier said, he said, "Why can't you play it? There's nothing derogatory about it in racial terms." And I said, "I can't do it." He never understood. And we don't get to talk about all his activism that he did. We don't get to talk about all the criticism that he received from both sides, you know, white folks and Black folks. He mentioned, you know, the sanitation of his characters. But, you know, if you want to find out more about his awards, about everything, it's just a rich story here. Please just CNN.com. You can read the whole thing for yourself. It just really gives you an idea of what he had to go through and might even paint a slight picture. I mean, we could make the case of the sort of things that we have to go through here on this show now. Q, you think?
Yeah, absolutely.
We have to play this game too, where we can't be too much. And, you know, I think our hearts are in the right place. We want to educate people. We want to love people. I think that's, and we want people to love each other, and we're in a position to do something. We have the skill set, we have the platform. So this is what we're doing with it. I mean, we could be making money and, you know, listening to music and all that sort of stuff, you know, and hanging out backstage, you know, but those days are over. We have a more meaningful journey at this point. So yeah, if you want to find out more, just check out CNN.com, Sidney Poitier, but that is our way, Black History Fact. Anything you'd like to add before we close, Q?
Continue to follow us, man. You know, the genesis of this show was born of our voices needing to be heard in spaces where traditionally they weren't. We never knew that it would turn into all that it's turned to. Like Ram just said at the start of the show, go on our social medias, check us out. We got some really, really cool and exciting things happening for us right now. And it literally is because of you all. So thank you guys so much for your support. Thank you for caring. Thank you for letting things that might not affect you directly mean something to you and allowing those things to be important enough for you to listen to us for a few minutes a week.
You know what? I'm glad you said that. And And I think that you're right. If you can, go check out our social media because you'll get the intricate details. But I will, you know, not every, I get it. Not everybody does that. Not everybody connects the dots in that way. So I'll just kind of let a little bit of it be known. Recently, we reached an agreement to help distribute the show. And so they're going to be adding several radio stations to our already bountiful lineup of affiliates across the country. Shout out to the Pacifica Network. Shout out to all the independent stations carrying this program. We're growing, and it's because of you, directly because of you. There's no other line that we can connect. So with that said, thank you for listening to Civic Cypher. I'm your host, Ramses Josh.
You go by the name Q Ward.
And until next week, y'all.
Peace. Hey, yo, we handle it. These brothers are fabulous. Yeah. Dilated.